Chapter 8. And I don't want the world to see me, 'cause I don't think that they'd understand. When everything's made to be broken, I just want you to know who I am. The gardens around the house stretch for dozens of meters, neat but sprawling. And it takes John longer than he would like to make it to the edge of them. This portion of the house is relatively quiet, though, and dark. There's a search party moving through it, but they're on the far side, sweeping rooms. John can feel their grim wariness, but he doesn't share it. There's no sense of wrongness, no enemies this deep in Jaster's territory. There's no proof that John can offer up, though, and he knows how people tend to react to mention of the Force, or John's particular unwavering belief in it, more immediate and less divorced than it is for even other Jedi. John was trained, though, raised to be as close to the Force as possible while still being alive, and he doesn't know how to put into words what he feels, especially not to people who can't touch the Force at all. This is quicker, though, even if John practically has to shuffle instead of moving with his usual speed. He can feel the tug of the Force, the gentle sense that there's somewhere else he needs to be. It's the same sense that pulls John from one mission to another, even when the Order hasn't sent him, but softer. He doesn't need to leave, just walk. Shouldn't leave, John thinks, pausing to catch his breath on the edge of an arching pavilion. He shouldn't leave, not just that he doesn't need to. This, here, with Jaster, that's the right choice, and for more reasons than just the life John took when he didn't have a right to it. There's something coming, a change, a threat. John can feel it rising like the shift in air pressure before a storm, sharp through his bones. Maybe part of it is the wedding, because Miles's fears feel entirely right, but there's something else as well. John can't see Shatterpoints, not without days of meditation and an effort that makes the ability far more trouble than it's worth, but he thinks this is likely what it feels like, and he would lay every credit in the galaxy on Jaster being that Shatterpoint, the embodiment of the change. Not all Shatterpoints are bad. The Mandalorians changing their system will leave the true Mandalorians in charge, the Death Watch fading back into the shadows, and peace will follow. If that breaks, nothing will change, and John has a cold, creeping certainty that the whole galaxy will suffer for it. There's a whisper of uncertainty in the back of his thoughts, his master's cold voice telling him he's projecting. That he's weak. That he's letting a desire, a bit of greed, overwhelm his good sense. Jaster already offered him the opportunity to leave, after all, and he could take it right now. Could leave, go back to his mission of tracking down smugglers, go back to helping people instead of indulging in excessive luxury. But even over Dark Woman's training, John trusts the Force. Trusts his connection to it, and the tether of it, and right now, the pull of the Force is centered here. John breathes in, breathes out, forces himself to straighten. Focuses, cataloging what he's feeling with the ruthlessness that Dark Woman taught him. He can't give himself quarter, can't let doubts creep in. If he's not absolutely sure of each motion, and sure in the conviction that it's for the right reason, he could find himself on the path to darkness all too soon. Everyone has darkness in them, but Jedi have the potential to do more damage than anyone else if they give in to that. Power used through fear, used for self-serving means, that's where the dark side rises. The only way to be sure to stay in the right is to know, pared down and peeled away to the very core, why he's doing the things he chooses. Anything less is walking a dangerous line. He breathes, and straightens, and like the moment of meditation by the river, there's a wash of soothing calm that instantly spreads out around him. Meditation is easy to slip into, even standing, even hurting, even when John had expected to have to struggle to empty his mind. The peace comes easily, and he breathes out the worry, the pain, the frustration with his own body, acknowledges all three, and sets them aside. Important, but not allowed to be a distraction. With a clear mind, it's easy to find his center, to steady his breathing and his heart rate, to submerge himself in the flow of the force. It's like sinking to the bottom of an ocean full of light and shadows, and there's that same sense of having to surrender, having to stop fighting if John wants to sink. The force is everywhere, in everything. It's energy and motion and each shift of the air in John's lungs, and if he's part of it, John can feel how it moves more clearly than he can feel his own thoughts. This is what Dark Woman wanted him to be all the time. She tried to push him until this state was natural, until he didn't have to think to fall into it. Over the course of their training, she stripped away his senses one by one, left him without any of them, and pushed him further still. And John had almost failed. If he'd loved her 1 ounce less, feared her 1 ounce less, he might have wavered, fallen, made her put him down when he slipped into darkness. But, even if he never managed to make this his permanent state, John still feels at his most centered, his most real, like this. The Jedi are just conduits, physical taps for the energy of the universe, and like this, John can feel that. He's frail skin and fragile bones just managing to encase a splinter of the Force. And if he reaches, if he listens, the splinter that makes him up still sings the same note as the whole. Certainty is easy when the overwhelming song of the universe is in his bones. A clear mind lets him see, lets him sort through himself. And John slides his fingers across the stone, pushes up as straight as he can. The twist of the Force is centered here on Conquered Dawn. The Force is beyond space and time. It bends toward those who shift it, change it. Jaster is one of those people, John thinks, and it's not just because he wants Jaster, even if he does. John can face that much about himself. He wants Jaster in a way he's never wanted another person before, a sweet ache low in his belly. The acknowledgement shivers through him, and John swallows, but it's true. Predictable. Desire is a normal thing to feel, and John's felt it before, but not to this extent. Never to the point that he wants Jaster's hands on his and eyes on him, and Jaster's body against his, for as long as he can keep them there. John grits his teeth, digs his fingers into marble. He sets the desire aside, accepts its existence, and looks past it, not about to let it influence anything else. And things remain the same. The Force bends toward Jaster like he's going to remake this whole portion of the universe single-handedly. Like something is happening around him that hasn't happened in a very, very long time. But it isn't just bending around Jaster. A little surprised, John opens his eyes, and he can almost see the energy around them, like a shadow glimpsed out of the corner of his eye. It shifts towards Jaster, shimmers with his fear and rising panic, but it branches. Jaster isn't the only shatter point here, John thinks, and turns his head. Miles had said Arlo was leading a squad towards the port, and she's what he feels there, a spotlight of vicious protectiveness and vengeful fury, ready to be unleashed. A beacon, a change in her own right, and John looks to her, then to the next warp of pending change. It's not far. Around the corner of the building, John assesses, and pushes away from the pavilion, each careful step carrying him right towards it. Django's change is more present, more immediate. He's actively changing the course of things, John thinks, and breathes out, letting himself shake off the stillness of that particular state of mind, focusing on the here and now instead of the universe as a whole. It feels like coming back to himself, like a blunting, a loss, the way it always does, but John lets himself feel the ache, focuses on putting each foot down without wavering, and rounds the edge of the house. There's a pool of light from a lamp, the edge of a shed, but John passes both, heading for a wild growth of roses that climb a latticework trellis. Beneath the trellis, invisible in the shadows cast by the roses, John can feel a body in pain, and he breathes out a sigh, ducking beneath the trellis and sinking down on the cool grass. Jaster is about to wake up the governor and have her start doing planet-wide scans, he says, which isn't that far off the truth from the feel of him. Django, unnervingly gray in the face and sprawled out in a way that means he probably collapsed more than sat down, huffs vaguely, eyes still tightly closed. "What's a Jedi care what my father's doing?" he demands, but there's no bite in it. John weighs his potential responses for a moment, then says, "Arla pointed out that I'm going to be your stepfather soon." Django pulls a face that's pretty much a direct translation of how John feels about that fact. "You're what, 26? He asks grumpily. Tipping one shoulder in a shrug, John settles back against the wall a little more comfortably. "I don't know," he says. "I was never told my life day." With a grunt, Django cracks an eye open. "You count the first day of the year?" he asks, and John hesitates, then shrugs. "No one asks," he says. "I don't tend to think about it." "What, the Jedi Order isn't throwing you some big celebration to honor their best?" Django's voice is cranky more than sharp, tired and tight with pain. John doesn't let the venom bother him. "I don't go back to the temple much," he says, and Django sighs like he's frustrated that John isn't rising to the bait. "You know my father's only marrying you so he can get into the Jedi Archives, right?" he asks, closing his eye again. "He and that librarian have been fighting for years." "Archivist," John corrects automatically, and Django groans disgustedly. "Two of you, criff," he mutters, and John ducks his head to hide his amusement. The silence settles, lingers, and John gives it several stretching minutes before he says, "You were trying to get to the ships." Django doesn't answer, but it's a tight, tense lack, like he's braced for John to start making accusations. John doesn't, just waits, watching him in the darkness of the roses, and lets the frustration and anger and dismay that Django is feeling wash over him. "Whatever you're doing, it's changing things," he says quietly, and the crack of Django's laughter is rough and halfway to bitter. "Course it is," he retorts. "That's why I'm doing it. Jaster's in danger," John finishes for him, soft, and he doesn't know what Django was doing, but he knows there's something. Something centered around Jaster and a decision, and something that's left Django feeling just as terrible as the wound in his stomach. "I'm not going to tell you," Django says, harsh, "and you're going to keep it to yourself, JT, if you want to make it to the wedding in one piece." John considers that, considers Django. Django's sure he's doing the right thing, and John doesn't have any proof of whatever accusations he might make. Telling Jaster his son was trying to get to a ship and leave the planet likely won't do either of them any favors when Jaster will realize that on his own easily enough. "You should stay," John says. "Something is going to happen here." Django opens his eyes, fixing John with a narrow look. "How do you know?" he challenges. John hesitates, trying to put the feeling into words. "Your ship," he says. "You know when the sound of the engines is wrong. If something breaks, you can feel the vibrations in the controls, and you know they're not what they should be. It's instinct." "Experience," Django corrects sourly. "I don't need some JT magic to..." "Instinct trained by experience," John allows, unwavering. "I feel that, but for everything." For a moment, Django just stares at him. Then, loudly, he snorts and reaches out, thumping John in the shoulder. It's sudden, and John only just controls a flinch at the impact, but it's not actually hard enough to hurt, and he swallows against a dry throat, against a heartbeat that's just a little too fast, and reaches out, offering Django his hand. "You didn't dodge," Django says accusingly, even as he takes John's hand. "If you can feel everything in the universe, you carking fake—" John blinks at him, a little taken aback. "You weren't attacking me," he says carefully. I wouldn't need to dodge. With a groan of clear disgust, Django shoves at him. Help me up, he orders, before the old man gets himself thrown in prison for annoying the governor when he's a felon. If Miles has to plan a wedding in a jail cell, he's going to snap and murder all of us. Leaning down and crouching both seem like bad ideas, so John doesn't try. Instead, he carefully shifts back, bracing a forearm against the wall, and pushes up. Django gets a hand hooked into the trellis and staggers up at the same moment, a sound of pure pain wrenched from his throat. He staggers and almost goes down, but John manages to catch him and keep them both on their feet, though there's a slightly dubious moment when they both waver dramatically, and John has to grab for the force to stay upright. Griff, Django finally manages, breathless and even grayer in the face. One hand is fisted, white-knuckled, in the shoulder of John's cloak. John doesn't point out that the open space where the ships are is up a hill, through a wall, and then across a stretch of open ground that would have left Django fully unconscious if he tried to traverse it by himself, if even coming this far had left him wheezing for breath and unable to walk. He's fairly sure he doesn't have the right to throw stones, though, given that Jaster ordered him to stay in bed, too. Careful, he says instead, and guides Django through the first few shaky steps out from beneath the trellis. He has to take most of Django's weight, but it's doable. John slept enough, recovered enough for this. They just need to get back towards the main part of the house so the search parties will find them. Django grunts, but distractedly. Most of his attention is on staying upright, and he hobbles along beside John, shaky and ready to fall, but John keeps a tight hold on him and doesn't let himself waver, even when his chest pulls unpleasantly. Why? Django manages after a few unwavering yards, and his hand goes tight in John's cloak again. You're... John has no idea how he intends to finish that sentence, but it doesn't matter. Jaster was worried, he says simply, and I could find you. Django casts him a sideways look, though he doesn't say anything for several minutes. It takes until they reach the edge of the garden before he huffs quietly and says, Heard you got Montross. Tipping his chin up, John refuses to look over. He knows what he did. I cut him in half. He was about to raid a town with other Death Watch members. Several seconds pass, and then Django sighs, annoyed, tired, pained. Good riddance, he finally says. You stole our family's justice, but... That Hutun needed to die somehow. John nods, and there's a growing ache spreading through his chest that's unpleasant, and probably not a good sign, but... I heard about his betrayal, he says quietly. The ambush. On quarter six, Django is quiet as he focuses on navigating a slight slope, then says, Yeah, Sithing traitor. Tor almost would have gotten us both. But Silas realized, calmed Arla, got us back up. There were vaguely similar stories floating around, and John nods, relieved they were true, if only for the picture they painted of the true Mandalorians coming back together in the wake of the incident. Whatever fractures there had been before, Jaster's near death had made all of them regroup, tighten ranks. They managed to push the Death Watch back, gain at least a little ground, and root out any of Montross's supporters before they could do any damage. Good, John says, about all he can manage, and feels a familiar curl of determination and cold, rising rage ahead of them. Closes his eyes, not able to summon the breath for a shout, but... A bench rattles, tips, resettles with a loud thump, and there's an instant reaction. Multiple boots on stone, the hum of blasters, and John looks up just in time to see Jaster's eyes go wide. Couldn't even be bothered with a shirt, old man, Django complains breathlessly, and when Jaster drags him right out of John's grip and into a bruising hug, he groans loudly. Ow! Just wait until your sister gets her hands on you, Jaster promises, but the fracturing relief in him makes John smile a little. Carefully, he takes two steps back and sinks down on the bench, watching as Jaster pulls back just enough to cup Django's jaw, looking him in the face. What were you thinking? Jaster asks, exasperated, and Django grimaces. "I'm sick of medical," he complains, though John can feel the way Django's attention is partially on him, braced for John to say something. John doesn't, just keeps his peace, and after a second, Django adds grudgingly, "Was going to find a speeder." Jaster closes his eyes for a moment, and the relief that trembles through him feels like a seismic shift, gutting and strong enough to realign continents. "You," he says, "are very lucky you're pretty, Django." Django splutters, offended, and half an instant later there's a cry from above. Thrusters cut out, and like a shadow come to life, Arla plummets out of the sky, her black and white armor catching the light. She hits hard, then hits Django hard, and Jaster prudently sidesteps just in time to keep all three of them from spilling to the ground. Instead, only Django and Arla hit, and Django yelps loudly, then promptly yelps again when Arla boxes his ears. "Forget your brain cell being lonely. You don't even have one," Arla says loudly, ignoring Django's attempts to pry her off of him. "You carking numbskull! Your grand escape plan was to make us think you'd been kidnapped!" "Ow, ow, ow, Arla, I'm hurt!" "That's the point, Django." Jaster laughs, but he takes another few steps away, and when John lifts his head, it's just in time to see a hand coming at his face. He flinches on instinct, ducking, but instead of a grab for his hair or a blow, Jaster blows out a breath and drops. John almost startles away from him as he lands on his knees at John's feet, but big hands catch his own, close tightly around them, and he freezes like his mind's gone entirely blank. Jaster is looking up at him, mobile expression still caught up in laughter and relief, and he raises John's hands, pressing them against his forehead for a long moment before he says, "John, thank you for finding him." John swallows, and he was expecting anger for not staying where Jaster told him to, not this, not Jaster's dark eyes on him, Jaster's hands tight around his own. Jaster on his knees, right in front of him, and John closes his eyes and ducks his head, trying to hide whatever his face must be doing right now. "Sorry," he manages. "I left." Jaster snorts. "For a good cause, if you are rescuing my son from his own foolishness," he says, and leans in. John can feel him, the heat of his bare chest close to John's hands, the touch of a hand on John's thigh, gripping lightly. His other hand settles over John's stomach, and he frowns faintly, looking up again. "You strained yourself. You could have calmed me." His palm is warm, and John can't quite breathe right. He can't think of anything except waking up with Jaster's arms around him, Jaster's breath between his shoulder blades, the prickle of stubble and the way his hands slid over John's skin. "John?" Jaster asks, concerned. John wants him. He wants to see what it's like to kiss Jaster, wants to slide down off the bench and press them together chest to chest and feel Jaster's bare skin against his own. Wants to run his fingers through Jaster's hair and pull his mouth closer and rub himself against Jaster's thigh. His skin feels hot with those thoughts, with those wants, oversensitive and exposed. Jaster isn't a Jedi, but John feels like every desire is carved into his skin for everyone in the world to see. Expecting him to form words when Jaster is touching him seems like too much to ask of anyone. I don't have your comm code," John manages, and if it's rough, almost inaudible, hopefully that can be blamed on the strain of too much movement. Jaster pauses, startled, and then chuckles. He leans in, and John can't hide the shiver that trembles through him at the brush of calloused fingers through his hair. Jaster tucks the wild strands back behind one ear, then leans forward and says, "This time I believe I have a very good excuse for this. Arms around my neck." John wants that too. Wants to be that close, even if it makes every muscle feel too hot and too tight all at once. Still, he hesitates, drawing back a little, and flicks a glance over Jaster's shoulder to where Arla and an unfamiliar man with brown hair are just hauling Django back up between them. "But Django," he says, and Jaster steals one look back over his shoulder and huffs out a laugh. Arla and Silas have him well in hand, he says, amused. I'll check in as soon as you're back in bed, where you should be. A thumb skims the curve of John's brow, and John shivers, ducks his head. Those words just make him think of Jaster's weight on his back, the arm around him, but he wants more. Not just a hand on his stomach, but Jaster's hand sliding lower, maybe slipping beneath the waist of his pants, smoothing across his hip bone and easing them down. John, Jaster asks, a little amused, you must have strained yourself if you can't even focus. John swallows, breathes. He wants, but Jaster is marrying him because of politics. He needs to remember that. It's important. Jaster is important. Sorry, he says quietly, and leans forward, wraps his arms around Jaster's neck. Jaster's hair is soft against his cheek, and his skin is warm, warm enough to make John close his eyes and just feel it. There's a moment of surprise, then a quiet chuckle, and one of Jaster's arms slides under his thighs, the other looping behind his back. There we are, Jaster says, and lifts, and it pulls for a moment, all across John's lower chest and stomach. He hisses before he can stop himself, burying his face in the curve of his arm, and Jaster hums softly, giving him a moment. More Bacta is in order, I think. Sleep, John manages after a moment. I felt better when I woke up. Yes, Jaster says, a little dryly, and starts moving, steps carefully deliberate. That would be what happens when you give your body time to rest. I appreciate you finding Django more than I can say, but we'll have to make preparations so that next time you don't injure yourself further. I felt him, John says, a vague attempt at explanation. In the Force, and I knew he was hurting. There's a sigh that ruffles his hair, and Jaster tightens his grip ever so slightly. Django learned his lesson, I think, he says, and there's a touch of humor to it. I doubt Arla will let him live this down until his next reckless stunt, but your participation in that one is strongly discouraged. Noted, John says. Jaster smells like the pillows John woke up on this morning, metal and sweat and something he can't name, but which brings up the thought of Jaster immediately. It makes John's mouth dry, makes his pulse a little quicker, and all John wants is to turn his face into Jaster's throat, set his mouth against the skin. It curls low in his belly, the wanting, and makes him feel shaky, unsteady, but not bad. Django says you only want to marry me to get past Madame New, he manages, and Jaster's aggrieved sigh is loud and annoyed and entirely fond, and John can't help the laugh that shakes out of him at the sound of it. Jaster doesn't deny it, just says, Django talks far too much for his own good, and pushes open the glass doors of the bedroom, letting them swing shut again behind them. End of chapter 8.